Ready?
Very well. Well, welcome everybody to the April 1st, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We got a number of bills up today. We're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 751. Go ahead, James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 751 establishes the Oregon Donor Registry and Public Awareness Fund and State Treasury as a separate and distinct from general fund, directs Oregon Department of Transportation to accept donations of $3 or more for the fund, adds a checkbox to driver permit, license, and ID card applications or renewals, as well as to online vehicle registration renewals, requires ODOT to transfer the monies in the fund after deducting expenses for collecting and transferring to the Oregon Procurement Organization that has established a donor registry in the state for the purpose of conducting statewide outreach and public education related to anatomical gifts. We do have a Dash 1 amendment, requires ODOT to maintain on its vehicle registration renewal website an online application form, a link to the website of the Oregon Procurement Organization that has established a donor registry in this state. We do not have a revenue or fiscal statement for the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. And we do have for the bill itself.
For the bill itself, we have fiscal light, and for revenue, we have no statement for revenue either.
Okay. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the state senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. It's a pleasure for me to be here to talk to you about this bill, which would create the Oregon Donor Registry and Public Awareness Fund. And I think I probably don't have to convince you of the importance of anatomical donation, just how important it is. I think we're all familiar with the connection between anatomical donation and driver's licenses, and there's obviously a natural connection there. You'll hear after I speak from people from Donate Life, which is the 501c3 nonprofit that tries to promote awareness of the program and try to extend donations from people of all ethnic groups and to expand the registries in the state. They made me aware this summer of some real challenges that we're facing in terms of donor registry and getting people aware of the program and able to participate in the program. And that's what led to this bill. There are a number of states, as you'll hear from them, that have created programs for voluntary donations to the fund to allow them to expand their educational and informational work that is done through their local DMV, again, building off of the tradition of that relationship between the DMV and anatomical donation. And we tried to see, is there a way that we could make that work here in Oregon? And I had a number of meetings with DMV about it and came up with an idea that is in this bill, 751. We went back to work some more on it to try to find ways to bring the impact down on DMV, the cost, and thus the fiscal impact. And we believe that we've done that here with this Dash 1 amendment, which it takes the basic idea of a checkbox on paper license applications for a $3 donation. Again, it's a very modest donation to Donate Life, but it allows this to be done via the DMV website and it restricts it. Initially, we were looking at it applying to the automobile registrations, the vehicle registrations, and now it just applies, I believe, to driver's license applications. So this will, I think you'll see a real reduction in the fiscal with these Dash 1 amendments. The operational costs for the program will come out of the fund. Once the startup costs are established, the ongoing costs for ODOT will be covered by the $3 donation to the donor registry and public awareness fund. So it's, you know, I think it's a program that's ready to go, and I think really warrants your serious attention. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. I will say that after me, you'll hear from members of Donate Life and from ODOT.
Okay. Questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Cassandra.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, colleagues.
All right. So Tracy Hoyle and Leslie Brock. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Brock. I'm the Executive Director at Donate Life Northwest, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 751, an act to establish the Oregon Donor Registry and Public Awareness Fund. As the sole anatomical donation education agency in Oregon, Donate Life Northwest has an ethical responsibility to broadly and adequately educate the public about donation and transplantation so that all Oregonians have the knowledge needed to make an informed decision. We work on behalf of local organ, eye, and tissue procurement organizations and transplant centers to grow the donor registry for the state and ultimately save lives. We also work on behalf of thousands of people like those you will hear from today. With a small staff and a modest budget, Donate Life Northwest has been able to make great progress and has grown the Oregon donor registry to almost 2.3 million people today. But despite the hard work of Donate Life Northwest, there is a large and growing gap between the availability and the need. As of this morning, there are 857 people on the waiting list in the state of Oregon, with average wait times as long as 2 years for an organ transplant. In Oregon in 2014, 36 people died waiting for a life-saving organ transplant that never came, and an additional 62 people were waiting long enough that they became too sick to become eligible for a transplant. Revenue earned from this voluntary checkbox would be used to significantly expand Donate Life Northwest's ability to reach and educate Oregonians about anatomical donation and the option to join the donor registry. We've done a great job in the Portland metro area, but we really need to reach further into rural and minority communities throughout Oregon. The need for donation and transplant touches all walks of life, regardless of race, gender, or station in life. Additional revenue would allow Donate Life Northwest to expand its student and community education programs, advertising and awareness efforts, and other campaigns needed to further our vision of ensuring that all people in Oregon who need a transplant do receive one. If we can save just one more life each year by expanding our reach to educate the community about the importance of becoming a donor, it would be well worth it. 36 states, including all of our border states, have successfully passed similar measures, generating significant dollars for donation and transplantation awareness efforts in their respective states. I urge you to move Senate Bill 751 forward. Passage will empower our fellow Oregonians to make a big difference in the lives of those waiting for transplants, as well as their families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Hoyle, and I'm a native Oregonian, currently live in Sandy. I've been here all of my life. I first of all would like to thank Senator Beyer and the committee members for allowing me to be here today to testify on behalf of Donate Life, as well as Senate Bill 751. I am a volunteer with Donate Life and have been for almost 15 years. My family's been on both sides of donation. When I was just 15 years old, my mom passed away unexpectedly. She was able to donate both of her corneas and one of her kidneys. As difficult as this was, it was kind of a comfort knowing that as she helped people in her life, she was going to continue to help people in her death. Not knowing that donation would ever touch my life after my mom's death, I sit here in front of you today, a two-time heart recipient and a kidney recipient. After 9 months and 3 weeks after my first heart transplant, I gave birth to a beautiful son named Trent. He would not be here without that donation. sorry. He's like the love of my life, so sorry. I am the lucky one. There are so many people that are waiting for transplants that don't get this opportunity, that pass away before that transplant comes. My last transplant was 2.5 years ago, and I didn't think I was going to be able to see my son turn 13. So education out there is so needed to get more people aware of donation. Yes, we have a very high number here in Oregon, but some of them don't even know what that means. I want to be out there educating people, and I want to honor my two donors by going out and educating people of all walks of life to tell them why it's so important. I've been able to take place in 2 half marathons this past year and multiple 10Ks and 5Ks, all because of this. So I urge you to move this bill forward so that we can touch more people's lives and people like myself can be saved through this program. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, personal, anything you have of me, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jan Schumacher and Scott Nance.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Byron. Thank you, committee, for having us here today and for hearing our testimony. My name is Jan Yearwood Schumacher, and I'm a native Oregonian. I was born and raised in Eugene, and I now reside in Portland. In 2000, I opened Tre Fabu Bridal in Portland, Oregon's largest bridal store encompassing 7,000 square feet and touching over 1,200 weddings annually. I am the survivor of a major medical episodic event and probably shouldn't be here today. During an international buying trip, I became ill and arrived back in the United States, deboarding via a wheelchair. While hospitalized, my small arteries gave way, and I began to bleed out internally. The CDC was unable to diagnose my illness, and I remain undiagnosed to date. Over 40% of the tissue on my body died as a result and had to be removed. I spent the next 6 months in the Oregon Burn Center, enduring 25 surgeries, some of them more than 12 hours long. That's better than one a week. In surgery, they replaced and reapplied donated tissue to my arms, legs, and hands until I became well enough to self-donate the skin you see today. It'd be easy to say that without the doctor's and nurse's skill, I would not have survived, but the equation is larger than that. For without donated tissue, there would quite simply have been no solution. When the Boston Marathon bombing event happened, their local tissue bank had to send out a national call for more tissue. Well, I personally made our local community tissue bank send out that call nationwide. I've just completed my 37th surgery. I'm hoping it's the last. Skin is our largest organ. It's our first line of defense from bacteria and viruses entering our bodies. And in 2014, 746 Oregonians donated tissue, resulting in over 64,000 tissue transplants. That's a significant donation. We need to continue to reach out and educate our citizens on the importance of the gift of sight, life, and mobility. People are aware of organ donation, and families may discount the gift of tissue and cornea donation due to a lack of education. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. If any of you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman Byron and members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. My name is Scott Nance. I live in Scappoose, Oregon, and I'm here for the same bill. I'd like to actually start by asking you to think about a couple of questions. I'm not looking for a response. I just want you to think about it because they're questions that I have and I ask myself all the time. Do you have loved ones that you love more than life itself? Children, grandchildren, or maybe that really special partner? Have you ever wondered what life would be like without them? How you might carry on? What if you were told that your loved one needed an organ transplant and if they didn't get it, they would die? Or worse, What if you were told that they'd been in a tragic accident and been declared brain dead? Doctors couldn't do anything to save their life. In the midst of the overwhelming loss, would you, could you allow your loved one to share the vital gifts that could save and enhance lives of total strangers? August 3rd, 2004, I found myself in that very place. I found myself in an ICU holding the hand of my 16-year-old daughter, Carrie, as she slipped away. And that's Carrie. Just about 6 months earlier, in her sophomore year, she had taken a health class from a teacher who valued the importance of organ, cornea, and tissue donation, and he'd taught about it. In fact, she actually did a report on that very topic. Never in our wildest nightmares did we ever think that in less than 6 months, we would be making that very choice for her. But that's where I was on August the 3rd, 2004. Carrie's gifts allowed four people to continue to live. She gave two people the gift of sight, and she improved the lives of numerous others. And it's kind of funny, but hindsight being 2020, and me sort of being a selfish person, I would tell you that knowing that she didn't just die in vain, that she was able to share in her death, and that through her loss, there are others that are still alive, actually helps us and has helped us through the grief process. But I would have to be honest with you and tell you that education was the key. If she had not been educated, if she hadn't come home and said, "Daddy, that's the coolest thing ever. I hope when I die, I get to be a donor." If she hadn't driven that home, I don't think in the emotion of the loss, I could have made that choice. I just don't think it was possible. We do a good job. You've heard some of my colleagues say, I'm a volunteer as well. It's not what I do for a living. But we do a good job in the Portland greater metro area. But there's a lot of rural areas that we need to do a better job at reaching. There's a lot of ethnic minorities that we need to do a better job at reaching. And this revenue, the revenue that would be earned from this voluntary checkbox, would help us to do just that. It would help us to extend our reach. So I urge you to pass Senate Bill 751. Help us extend our reach. Thank you.
Thank you.
And like the others, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you very much. Tom.
I know how to clear a room, I guess. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator with the Department of Transportation. I'm here to speak to you on Senate Bill 751. The Department of Transportation has assisted in registering Oregonians as anatomical donors for decades, 40 years actually, in successful partnership with Donate Life Northwest. Senate Bill 751, as introduced, would add a collection of monetary donations by DMV for Donate Life Northwest, and it would have a significant impact on our department resources. Since 1975, the Oregon DMV has partnered with Donate Life Northwest, formerly the Oregon Donor Program, in the important work of signing up Oregonians as anatomical donors. When an Oregon resident age 15 or older applies for a driver license, a driver permit, or an ID card, DMV employees ask those people, "Do you want to become a donor?" If they say yes, we add the D to their card, and that information is made available then to the donor registry. We pass that on a regular basis to them. So that information is passed along consistently and routinely. That is provided by law as well, as in statute, that we would do that. In addition to the active solicitation of customers to become anatomical donors, we include program information in our driver manual, displays in our field offices, and we provide a link to the Donate Life Northwest website from our own website. So there's that nice, easy connection to their organization. As of March of this year, over 1.7 million Oregonians have active donor designations on those cards. None of that activity is allowable within the state highway fund under the constitutional limitations that we operate under. It's an activity that's not allowable under the Constitution. Instead, the department pays for that work, that expense, through what we call the Transportation Operating Fund, a small fund maintained by the Department of Transportation for activities that are not allowable under the Constitution. So we're charging that time, that expense, to that fund. Senate Bill 751 adds a substantial new duty to the department. It would require DMV to accept monetary donations when a customer applies for a new or renewed driver license, driver permit, or an ID card, and also accept monetary donations for those online vehicle registration renewals that was mentioned earlier. It has permissive language about in-person vehicle registration renewals. It doesn't require that, but it would allow the agency to also collect donations for those types of transactions in our field offices. Both the field office and the online components of the bill will require significant and expensive computer system changes for us, require additional time with customers by our staff, time that we would have to charge to some other source of revenue. None of that work is allowable within the highway fund, and in the bill as it introduced, there is no funding source identified. As such, we've assumed general fund would be provided to pay for that additional expense. We contribute substantial time, financial resources to this very, very worthy activity. We, like I said, partner very closely with this organization. We celebrate annually with them the successes of the partnership. Next week we'll receive a quilt from donors that have been created. It'll be displayed in our DMV offices. And it's a partnership that we're very proud of. And I think it's worked very, very well over these 40 years. Our concerns really deal with that cost, and maybe it's a policy question for you is whether a state employee should be collecting money on behalf of nonprofit organizations.
Senator Thompson?
I don't know if the group met with you about this before. Could you put in an admin fee and cover your costs?
It would have to come out on top.
Yeah, I mean, you can come up with a number, and why couldn't you do that?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, we would need your authority for some kind of a surcharge or an extra charge to go on top of that.
I'll give you my authority.
We want to make sure it covered our administrative expenses. We are in the process of implementing credit and debit cards in our field offices. So if on that transaction the person says, I want to donate $20 or $100.
It would be a cost there.
It's going to be a cost. So we're going to have to recover that merchant fee. It's about 2% on any transaction.
This would effectively, if we want with this, would be similar to how we deal with the specialty license plates, where the cost is borne up front.
Mm-hmm.
And then ongoing costs are covered first before any additional revenue is transferred.
Yes.
Well, there's precedent sort of for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So always the question is always, where's the upfront money come from? In the case of the license plates, the organization has to provide the money up front.
Right. And sometimes those license plates, even though everybody thinks they're a great idea, they don't generate enough money to pay the cost.
That's right.
So there's always that gamble.
In this case, just looking at the revenue, which is a preliminary,
uh-huh.
It suggests it would require a general fund appropriation of $400,000 to reprogram the computers?
Chair Beyer, as introduced, the amendment that was mentioned previously would reduce the amount of that upfront cost. We haven't finished calculating that impact yet. We just got the Dash 1 amendment.
I was trying to figure out the Dash 1s. It looks like it's just an addition, not a takeaway from what's there. Am I not reading that correctly?
Chair Beyer, it focuses on the online part for vehicle registration renewals. It provides the option to divert the person to another website where they can actually make that donation. We do that with veterans today. At
right.
The conclusion of the registration renewal transaction, you're given a choice. Would you like to give money to this cause? What I understand the Dash 1 to do would be give that person the option to go to that website, make that donation, and if they choose to come back to our website afterwards. It still leaves in place the in-person in the field office for those driver license and ID card transactions. for us to be able to accept those donations in the field offices.
Would that require a reprogramming?
Yes, it would.
Either or both of those require some degree of reprogramming.
Yes, they would.
And so I guess you're saying that it would be less than the 400 that's here?
Chair Meyer, I believe it would be less.
I guess I have another question. You're about to, I hope, embark on an upgrade to your computer systems. Would this happen to the existing system, or are we talking about something that would be added into the revised system?
Chair Beyer, depending on the time frame, it looks like it would be done to the old system, mm-hmm. to the current system we have in place today. In many ways, it diverts us from what I consider the most important thing for us to be working on, is replacing our computer systems and getting to the new world where things are so much better. Because of the time frame and the dates in this bill, we would most likely change the existing systems to be able to accommodate this.
So I'm assuming the new system, if we were to do this, the new system, it would just be a feature that was added to.
Chair Beyer, if it was, especially in statute, as a requirement, we would make sure it would be a capability of the new system to do that.
So it probably wouldn't substantially change that cost.
It's too early in the process to really say it would cost any more or less to add that capability. We don't accept donations for any other cause in field offices today.
Yeah, we're never very overly concerned about computer system upgrades. Okay. Senator Girard.
Sorry, I have to ask this question because this to me is a pretty worthy cause, and mm-hmm. and all of a sudden we're coming in with some pretty high costs, you know, the $400,000. We just passed voter motor, which if anything was huge, that was it, and we seem to have a minimal fiscal on that. So can you explain why a minimal fiscal on that, and this one comes in at $400,000? It's kind of hard for me to understand that.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it's really the difference between modifying something you're already doing today, which we do today with the voter capabilities that we have in place and the relationships we have today with Secretary of State's office. We already transmit data to them for voter registration purposes. So it's fairly minor changes that we're making to accommodate that particular change. This is completely new. And this touches our core systems, our vehicle system, and an online system to make adjustments that are more costly, more expensive for us to make. With the old technologies that we have in place today.
Other questions? Jeannie, thank you.
Yep, you bet.
Well, colleagues, our option is we could, I guess,
do we have to wait for... We have to wait until the statements come in because we don't have the revenue statement for the original and we don't have either for the amendment. No,
Mr. Chair.
All right, so...
Mr. Yeah. Chair.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. It occurs to me that this is a very worthwhile cause, and I believe, whether the department would like to say it or not, that implementing this at the time we implement a new system would be less expensive. I think we should look at that possibility of putting this off just long enough to see if that could be done.
And you might get to see that in your subcommittee.
Yes, I know.
Well, we can't do anything on it today because we don't have all of the paperwork. So we will reschedule this one. And so for the benefit of the audience who are not familiar with our procedures, by Senate rule, we cannot move a bill until we have the fiscal and the revenue impact statements. So we'll have to wait for those, and we'll bring it back and probably next week. Okay? So that's all I had signed up to testify on Senate Bill 751. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on that? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 751. And
Senator Fiore Ferriola is not here yet, so we could start with 872 if you want.
First,
She's not?
She's not.
Okay. So where is that?
It's the top. Yeah.
So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 872. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 872 increases amount of maximum total tax credits for certified film production development contributions for fiscal year, limits amount of expense reimbursement for filmmakers other than local filmmakers, increases limit on reimbursement for local filmmaker and media production services company, applies to fiscal years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015, takes effect on 91st day following adjournment of Sunday die. We do have a -1 amendment. It includes language that allows the Oregon Business Development Department to reimburse a local media production services company for a portion of the actual expenses incurred by a filmmaker or local media production service company in Oregon. We have no revenue or fiscal statements issued for the -1 amendment, and on the original bill, we have a revenue light, and there is no fiscal impact on the original bill. And also it has a subsequent referral to JTAX.
Okay. So, do I have one? Here you go. Oops. I have, let's see, Tim Williams. Thank you. I got it. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Okay.
And then we'll suspend.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tim Williams, and I'm the executive director of Oregon Film. And I am here to give you a general overview of the film, TV, and media economy here in Oregon and the film production tax incentive for which the Senate Bill 872 are addressing. Over the past several years, thanks to the legislation's implementation of Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, we have seen steady broad growth in Oregon's film and television industry. The number of jobs, the amount of annual wages, and the number of companies based here in the state have all seen sizable increases over the last 5 years. Information provided by the Department of Employment shows that Oregon's film and TV industry grew by 69% from September 2009 to September 2014. Nearly 1,000 jobs were added over the course of that same five-year period. Average annual pay for the industry was over $43,000 in 2013, and in the third quarter of last year, at least 351 companies in the state were engaged in motion picture and video work. Oregon Film oversees and administers OPIF and its affiliated program called the Indigenous Oregon Production Investment Fund, or IOPIF, as well as the Greenlight Oregon program. Together, these programs refund up to 20% of goods and services being spent in-state and 16.2% of verified wages for cast and crew working in the state. It's important to note that these programs do not rebate any funds to project producers or production companies until all in-state spending has already occurred and has been verified. Generally speaking, this spending exceeds the rebate by 10-to-15-to-1 ratio, and the turnaround time for these projects can generally be measured in months as opposed to years. This program is now capped at $10 million per year, and last year that cap was hit within a few weeks of the program's resetting, and this year, because of a repeat business and the growth of the multi-year TV series that are based here in the state, the OPIF program will be oversubscribed even before it resets in July. The steady growth of in-state spend versus incentive payout continues to grow on a year-by-year basis, from just over $35 million of verified in-state spend in 2009 to more than $135 million just for OPIF program being tracked for this fiscal year. For the fiscal year 2014-2015, OPIF is tracking 24 projects made up of feature films, TV series, digital content, post-production, documentaries, animated features and short films, and interactive game development. These are projects which have shot and based themselves in places like Eugene, Klamath Falls, Ashland, Hillsboro, and Malala. However, after reaching the funding cap for OPIF program last year, many projects have called our office to look possibly to shoot here in the state, and these are in equal parts local producers and companies as well as companies from outside the state, and these companies have decided to take their attention to other states or incentive programs like Canada. By way of example, the Fox TV series currently on air entitled Backstrom is set in Portland but is shot in Vancouver, B.C. In addition, the HBO miniseries about Lewis and Clark, based on the book Undaunted Courage, is currently prepping to shoot in Atlanta and Calgary. And lastly, director Kelly Reichert, who has shot four of her previous films in places like Hood River, Medford, and Burns, is shooting her current project, which is set in eastern Oregon, in Montana. This is in addition to homegrown projects, which have acquired very recently in Newburgh and LeGrand. This is an interconnected economy. And for every production that is developed and financed from sources outside of the state, many local companies gain work and grow their experience and workforce because of the work being brought into the state. So when the TV series Grimm uses Hive visual effects for its digital creature creation, Hive then has the capacity to work on national campaign for projects like ServPro and sustaining a permanent business model that is based here in the state, hiring full-time employees. Another example of this interconnected economy can be seen through the lens of the feature film Wild. Shot throughout the state, Wild had a direct impact during its production. More than 250 local vendors were engaged on some level in 23 Senate districts and 37 House districts, having an impact on two-thirds of the legislative map. In addition, it employed more than 200 people, including cast and crew, and spent more than $600,000 in hotel and travel costs alone. More than $110,000 was spent in local accommodations in the Mount Hood National Forest and Cascade Locks. But it also has and will continue to have an impact on tourism throughout the state. Through a unique partnership with Travel Oregon, our office not only held screenings of the film in various parts of the state last December, but we also worked closely with the film's distributor to ensure that the state of Oregon itself was prominently highlighted in all national markets. The beauty of our state is abundantly clear in this award-winning wide-release feature film, and it will undoubtedly lead people to come here and hike the Pacific Crest Trail and visit many of the state's iconic locations featured in the film, Crater Lake, Mount Hood, Ashland, and the Badlands outside of Bend. In a more specific example of local business benefiting from international audiences of these projects, Fox Searchlight Pictures approached Oregon-based Danner Boots in 2013 to create a custom boot for the film Wild, replicating the iconic boot on the cover of the book upon which the film is based. The Portland-based factory is able to respond quickly, delivering several dozen pairs to the crew shooting throughout Oregon. In addition to manufacturing the boot, known as the Mountain Light Cascade, for the film, Danner worked closely with Fox Searchlight and marketing team to develop an extensive public relation and promotions plan, selling the boots throughout retail partners like REI, Urban Outfitters, and Danner stores. The boot was offered in a period-specific box made for the film, along with a patch calling out the Pacific Crest Trail marker for Mount Hood. And during the fall of 2014, the Mountain Light Cascade became one of Danner's best-selling styles for women, helping to grow an emerging category for the brand. A complementary program of the OPIF Fund is the Indigenous Oregon Production Investment Fund, or IOPIF. Introduced in 2009, IOPIF is a reserve part of the OPIF Fund that solely focuses on Oregon-based products, producers, companies, and creators. Since its inception, IOPIF has helped nearly 60 local projects get to completion and distribution, which has helped to establish and grow the national and international reputations of brick-and-mortar companies in Eugene, Ashland, and Oregon City, and locally created films, TV series, interactive games, and documentaries embracing the entire state. It is the growth in this game development and other post-production services companies here in Oregon, which is addressed by the -1 amendments in the proposed SB 872. And lastly, it's important to note the attention and growth being garnered by the game development companies of Oregon. Since the game development was made part of IOPIF program in 2013, several of the state's local companies have used it as a tool to grow their workforce and develop their own projects. This is as much an innovation industry as it is an entertainment industry, and in the last 2 years, 11 interactive games have taken advantage of the IOPIF program, leading to the Electronic Software Association to rank Oregon in the top 10 of all U.S. states in game development. The media industry in Oregon is growing. This business is a word-of-mouth business, and thanks to the success of past projects and the growth of our local creative workforce, the interest and demand for more production in Oregon is at an all-time high. Thanks to all this activity, I believe we have opportunity not only to land more film and television production, but we are now being recognized as a player in the ever-changing digital media landscape. But the capacity of the program is not large enough to accommodate this additional work. For additional reference, I have submitted some documentation on the bill, a brief synopsis of some of the recent work done in the state, and a recap of some of the data I have presented here today. And I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Questions? Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much, Tim. I'm going to temporarily recess the hearing on Senate Bill 872. We'll get back to that in a minute. So, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bills 192, 807, and 818. James?
Sure. Senate Bill 192 is a bill that we have heard before, but it does have a -5 amendment. The State Parks and Recreation Department shall convene a work group that includes users of all-terrain vehicles, all-terrain vehicle dealers, staff from the Department of Transportation, and other individuals whom the State Parks and Recreation Department deemed necessary for the purpose of examining options for allowing users of all-terrain vehicles to operate on state highways. The department shall submit a report no later than September 15, 2016. This has a minimal fiscal impact and has a no revenue impact and will need to add a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
One at a time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back, Senator.
One at a time suits me just fine. State Senator Ted Farrioli, here to address Senate Bill 192, the -5 amendment. Dogs, guns, and pickup trucks. Those are areas where you can have endless controversies, and to that list we could add ATVs. Mr. Chair, a constituent of mine came to me and asked if 22 states have some sort of use on ATV on roadways, and 35 states have passed laws expanding ATV uses or allowing some sort of ATV use on roadways. Why are they prohibited in Oregon, except under very specific circumstances, and that would include the agricultural use if they have a warning diamond indicating that they're a slow-moving vehicle. Mr. Chair, the -5 amendment directs the State Parks and Recreation Department to convene a work group to explore options to allow ATV use on roadways in certain circumstances. One of the interesting anomalies of our state highway system is that our state highway system, which runs throughout the state, often is the main road in many of our towns and cities, particularly in District 30 and other places where we have vast distances between small settlements. Folks use the ATVs to get around on their rural properties, and very often they have to cross a state highway. Under certain circumstances, that is currently illegal. They would like to be able to use ATVs for short trips, including even perhaps a run to town for a quart of milk, rather than firing up the 4x4, the diesel-powered motor sled. They would rather hop on the ATV and make the two-minute run for convenience purposes. Many towns and cities offer the use of golf carts, golf cars, and similar vehicles for folks to get around. That is not currently legal. They sort of just don't do any enforcement. But there is a group of folks who really would like to use ATVs in a more programmatic way, in a more legally sanctionable way, and the purpose of the work group would be to convene the interested parties to have a discussion about how that might occur. It's deemed that the issue is not yet ripe for action in terms of just outright legitimization of the use of ATVs on roadways. Certainly there's some concern ODOT and others have expressed about safety on short distances on highways or crossing highways, and those issues have to be addressed. What we would like to do is have the Department of Parks and Recreation convene that work group, have the Oregon Department of Transportation, the user groups, the vehicle dealers, the recreationists, and others get together and talk about under what circumstances legal licensure would occur for the use on roadways, and then submit a report to the appropriate interim committee so that this could be considered in the 2016 session.
Yeah, sounds good. Questions? We'll move on. Okay.
work session on that?
We might want to ask others, since we have a public hearing, if they want to testify on that. Mm-hmm. We'll take care of it. Don't worry. Let's move to 807. James.
Senate Bill 807 provides that cities and counties that meet certain criteria are job creation zones. Details criteria for zones of at least 25% of the residents of city or county have incomes below 75% of the mean income of the state during the two most recent years. The rate of unemployment exceeded 7% for the two most recent years, or the population of the city or county has declined in the two most recent federal decennial censuses, or for the five most recent years. Extends certain benefits to residents, employers, and job creation zones, including no capital gains tax earned on investments made by residents of a job creation zone, and a job creation zone may waive any state regulation that inhibits job growth. It takes effect on 91st day following adjournment of sign to die. There is a revenue light statement and a fiscal light statement, and also has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue.
Mr. Chairman, relative to Senate Bill 807, this is an unapologetic, unabashed attempt to try to provide a few more tools in the toolbox for communities that really have not had any economic gains since the previous recession, not the last recession, but the one in the late 80s. If you look at the population dynamics of some of the communities in our district, District 30, Senate District 30, House District 59, and 60, and other places where the term frontier isn't just a jocular expression of what people expect when they get there, but actually fit the federal definition of less than six persons per square mile. If you look at the population dynamics in those communities, some of them have not grown at all in the last two decades. In fact, many are losing population. Anything that we can do to help those communities economically diversify will help lift the burden in the local community for funding their local infrastructure, including roads, schools, hospitals, fire districts, and so forth, and also help lift the burden on transfers from the general fund, which are really transfers from the urban area to the rural area. The bill has a fairly high bar for qualifying. During the two most recent years, at least 25% of the residents must have incomes below the 75% of the median. Some of our districts are only scoring about half the median income. They would have had to have declining populations in two of the most recent decadal census. That's over a 20-year period. And then the rate of unemployment would have to be at least 7%. If you look at the E6 unemployment and break it down by county, you'll see that the counties that we're really aiming at are in double-digit unemployment even today. And during the best part of the recovery from the previous recessions, they don't get out of double-digit unemployment in many cases. So it's fairly specific. It's basically using tax forgiveness incentives to try to stimulate investment in those communities. It's a strategy that we've used successfully elsewhere, and it will have definitely have a fiscal impact, although because the bar is set high and there are pretty tight descriptors, including median income, population loss, et cetera, we don't expect it to break the bank. So, Mr. Chair, we'd like to see 807 move forward to become a new tool in a job creation for very rural, very impoverished communities.
Thank you, Senator. All right, so we'll move to the last one then.
Senate Bill 818 directs Department of Transportation open field offices to public on Saturdays, declares emergency effective on passage. No revenue impact, and there's a fiscal light impact. And we also need to add a subsequent referral.
Mr. Chairman, this is simply a matter of practicality. In communities where we do have DMV offices, they are open weekdays, and many of the folks that work outside of the communities have to make a special trip into the city. You know, in some cases that's an hour or more one way to make sure they get in during business hours. What we're suggesting is opening these offices on Saturdays. It wouldn't necessarily have to be for a full day. Mr. Chairman, I expect that there will be some negative testimony, possibly even from the Department of Transportation, but I will refer you to a recommendations of Task Force on Transportation and Customer Service Efficiency conducted by the Oregon Department of Transportation relative to DMV offices, which recommends extending the hours of offices, including evenings and weekends. Simply a matter of convenience, something to provide better customer service. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, question? Senator Thompson.
Are you proposing to make those ATV accessible?
Well, put it this way.
Wrong bill, Senator.
Oh, wrong bill, sorry.
It'd be a great opportunity for, if we do end up using, providing a license opportunity for ATVs, perhaps there would be some interface with the Department of Motor Vehicles. Thanks for that specious question,
Mr. Chair. Questions, Senator?
Probably not. No, I'll behave myself. Duct tape.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thanks for the indulgence on allowing me to group the testimony on these three bills. It helps me get through my day.
Why don't you get back to your busy schedule? All righty. So we'll go back to the top then. Let me ask first, is there anybody who wants to comment on Senate Bill 192? Please. I'm assuming there's no lot here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ethan Ludwig. I'm living in Eugene, Oregon. I just wanted to thank you very much for your attention to Senate Bill 192, as well as the opportunity for OHV users and the rest of Oregonians to benefit from an effective piece of legislation that has been given the time to be created well. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Power Sports Association. Just want to add our voice to the amendments. We think it's a good idea to continue to study this issue and look for things that might work. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 192? Hearing none. Close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 192. The chair moves the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 192. Discussions. Is there any opposition? The amendments are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 192 with the dash 5 amendments to the Senate.
Do we have to go to the... Yeah, we got to do that crazy little thing.
Okay. With the due pass to the floor with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think since we're moving, this simply makes a work group and we're going to study this further. I think this is a good measure for us to go forward with. Thank you.
And let me ask committee staff here. We have a conflict. Our agenda says finance and revenue.
That one's for 807.
Oh, it's the next one down.
Yep. So 192, we just got to add it.
We always get confused about where that little phrase is on there. Okay. Further discussion on that? Seeing none, is there any objection?
Mr. Chair, if I vote yes, does that increase or decrease my chances of being on the work group?
I'll let you discuss that with Senator Ferrioli.
Okay.
I think he'd be really good.
He'd be really good at it, though.
Senator
we could
Ferrioli
recommend
would
that.
Would be really good on this committee.
You would.
Then yeah, I would okay. probably vote no then.
Anyway, seeing no objections, Senate Bill 192, as amended by the dash fives, is moved to the floor with a due pass via the Committee on Ways and Means.
Well, can I ask a question? Why are we sending it to Ways and Means? It's a work group, for God's sakes.
It takes money.
Work groups can be non-funded.
I don't make the rules. We're closed the public hearing on that. Is there anybody who has any comments on Senate Bill 807? Don't see any. Actually, I think we might move that down to finance. So we'll close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 807. The chair moves Senate Bill 807 to the Committee on Finance and Revenue, the due pass recommendation.
What you gotta do,
Senator Riley.
I have a small concern about this bill, and that is the, I think it was section 1-4, that says that the city can waive all state laws. And
needs further work.
Thank you.
That's why it's going to finance.
Okay. I'm on finance, so I'll wait to take that.
Other comments? Is there any objections to the motion? Okay. Senate Bill 807.
It's a two-pass, right?
Huh? Senate Bill 807 moves to the Committee on Finance and Revenue with the two-pass recommendation. So we'll close on that. And we'll close the public. Oh, wait a minute. I got to ask first. Is there anybody who wishes to test the bill on Senate Bill 818?
The agency, probably.
Do you want to testify, Tom? Oh, Kathy wants to. Okay.
Does Senate Bill 818?
Okay. Have at it.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 818 would require DMV offices, and we interpret it as one motor carrier port of entry, to be open on Saturdays. There was a legislative task force that was created looking at DMV and customer service and the efficiency of our field offices, and they did not recommend opening on Saturdays or extending hours. To maintain full service operations 6 days per week would require substantial highway fund resources. The bill is fairly vague in the way it's written. It's a struggle for us to interpret what it means by shall be open on Saturdays. Does that mean Monday through Saturday? Does it mean an hour on Saturday? Does it mean Tuesday through Saturday? We're really not sure what is intended there. In doing our fiscal analysis on it, we are assuming the intent is that it be open 6 days per week. So you will see a fiscal that shows adding an extra day per week to DMV operations to be open on Saturdays.
Tom, didn't you used to be open on Saturdays in some places?
Chair Beyer, yes,
and
yes, we did.
Extended hours as well?
We've had, in our history, a number of times where we had offices that were open. We had one, actually, that was open Monday through Saturday in Medford for some period of time. We've had express offices that were open, say, Tuesday through Saturday, a few hours potentially, where a more limited scope of service would be available to the public, not the full range, not necessarily a drive test, not new driver licenses, but just certain transactions could be done from an express office. About 3 years ago, we moved from a Tuesday through Saturday service to a Monday through Friday. We're now statewide, with five exceptions. We have five offices that are not open a full week. They can be open one day a week or once every 2 weeks. Enterprise is open 3 days per week. But 55 of those 60 are open 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, with fairly consistent hours for the public to know. If I go to DMV, I know what hours they'll be open.
What experience when you had the other offices? Did you get much use?
Chair Beyer, with the extended hours, we did not have much many people turn up for those. As we closed some offices in the Portland area, for example, Clackamas Town Center, Lloyd Center, when we closed those offices, we took five offices and extended their hours to Monday through on Mondays and Fridays to 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. And we did that for 9 or 10 months. 1 to 3% of the day's customers would come in between 5 and 6 p.m. in a 10-hour day. You would think at least 10%, if it was equally distributed throughout the day, 1 to 3%. So too often our employees sat there twiddling their thumbs, basically, waiting for the next person to come in the door. We did not get much response from the public to those extended hours. Saturday service, we've seen the same thing. With the availability of online services, registration renewal can be done online. You can change your address. You can notify us of a change of vehicle ownership. More things can be done through the mail. We have longer periods of time for a driver's license, and vehicle registration for new cars is 4 years instead of 2 years. It just has reduced the number of people coming to those offices over time. So for the sake of efficiency and consistency, we've gone to Monday through Friday for our services.
So about the only thing you can't do through the mail is the renewal of your driver's license?
Sure, Buyer, it does require a new photograph every 8 years for a driver's license. We do need to have you in person for those transactions. Most everything else can be done online or through the mail.
And I think when I was talking with Amy, there was a discussion about even if you were open on a Saturday for driver's license, the computers don't talk to each other, computers being the feds, the background checks and all that, that the federal government now requires you do. They don't want to go there, but do them anyway.
That is a consideration. Some of the systems we rely on to verify Social Security numbers or immigration documents, checking with other states on potential suspensions of drivers in other states, is done electronically through systems that are not always available on the weekends. They're either down for their own maintenance or they're just down on Saturdays. So we've increasingly become more reliant on those types of systems to do are just basic core services that we provide.
It's possible that if you were open for convenience, you may actually have some irate customers when they came in and found out they couldn't do it anyway.
You're right. Right.
Senator Girard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I would have, and it relates to the bill, is a lot of people, their spouse and themselves work, and Saturday really is the only convenient time to come in. I do know that the car dealerships and whatever need you to be open on Mondays, but I was just thinking if it was Tuesday through Saturday, there wouldn't be very much impact, revenue impact to you, would there, if it was Tuesday through Saturday?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, a certain number of our headquarters staff would have to flex their schedules. We may need some additional people to support the offices on Saturday. The courts, law enforcement, insurance companies, banks, you named a few others, operate Monday through Friday. They expect to still have access to us. And a lot of that work and the phone agents are from our headquarters building. And so we would need to be open Monday through Friday for those functions. In order to support the field offices, if one or more were open on Saturdays, we would need certain staff available to answer certain questions so that we didn't turn the public away. That's, to me, the worst thing that can happen is you wait a period of time, get up there, try to do your transaction, and you don't have what you need, or we can't finish the transaction, we send you away to come back. So I want to avoid that as much as possible as far as, like you said, customer service.
Okay. Senator Monroe?
Under current law, if in a particular community the agency felt the necessity to be open part or all of Saturday, could you do that?
Chair Byers, Senator Moreau, yes. Within current statute, we would have the authority to do that.
And, Mr. Chair, I would prefer to leave them that flexibility.
Anything else to add? Catherine?
I can do a real short, quick version. I was the Catherine Weber from Salem. I was the chair of the House Task Force 4047 that was a result of Representative Cameron's bill last session. And it set up a task force. On the task force, there were two now senators and one member of the House of Representatives. And as a very quick kind of summary, I assume you've got background you need. I can also do the long version if anybody wants. But reading from our task force report that I think was referenced earlier, I'm not positive it's the same one, but I chaired the one that just did the report last December. The prominent customer complaint about DMV services is long waits in the field offices for service. Increased staffing or extended hours could offer some improvement for customers, but the need for significant back office support makes extended hours an expensive proposition. The task force recommends that DMV provide greater opportunity to, or the task force recommendations provide greater opportunity to expand options for customers and improve service delivery. We broke our recommendations down in terms of how the customer, from a customer's point of view, And essentially, first strategy, avoid the field office in the first place, move as much traffic as you can to the internet. And then there's a number of things right about that. The second strategy, speed up the field office visit. And probably the most critical thing in there is to add debit credit cards to the queue so that the confusion about not taking anything but cash or check goes away. And then the third recommendation was to improve customer experience while waiting. Put in, there's a number of suggestions, and they're in the report itself. The last comment I'd like to make, because as the most important finding, and I think thing that struck members the most, and I want to see if make sure I get it correct, was how struck we were, in fact, almost stunned by the rudimentary nature of the computer systems DMV has and the paper systems they're forced to work with. Significant. This is kind of maybe old stuff for those of you who are on committees listening to the same issues, but significant parts of the system were, the system was put in 1978, so it's, the core system is 37 years old, before the internet, before PCs. I was the Senate chair of the JCL-IMT back in the 1990s and are fairly familiar with the first attempt to upgrade or to replace the DMV computer system. DMV is still using microfiche and microfilm. Some of the input screens are function key screens. I don't know if all of you know what those are, but they're incredibly confusing and take about 3 months to learn how to use for people who were quick. Anyway, the bottom line, I think, is that bringing up a new computer system is ultimately going to give you a whole lot better return on investment. I'd also like to add, and then I'll be quiet. I'm over at the Willamette Institute to Modernize Government in the business school. We've had three student projects looking at cost-benefit of debit-credit, cost-benefit of expanding internet, and another one on field studies.
We'll leave that piece to Senator Riley and his IT section.
Okay. So I have a recommendation. Go for the one latte solution to the $90 million problem, and that is increased fees by $3 to $5 for each transaction. And I've talked around to my buddies and friends that hang out in Starbucks and other places, and given the average hourly wage of Oregonians is $17.81, if they spend an hour there, the latte solution makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Different issue.
It is a different issue, but can I ask Tom?
You sure can.
I mean, she did bring up an interesting point, and that is debit and credit cards. Debit cards, at least to my knowledge, there isn't a fee for those, is there? And a credit card, there's
still a fee.
Chair Byers, Senator Girard, I think it's a flat rate. It's not based on the value of the transaction, so it is actually less than a regular credit card. And credit cards have different rates depending on what you use, a Visa, American Express.
But the three, I know credit, most credit cards are like 3% or something like that. It just seems to me like the number of bad checks that you would get in the processing the bad checks, that you'd be better off to take the credit card and get the money up front. But that's just me. I see somebody else nodding.
Chair Byers, Senator Girard, we do accept checks and cash. Those are the only two things we accept in field offices. And in putting credit and debit card capabilities in our field offices, initially at least, we plan to continue to accept checks. At some point, we could stop doing that. But as long as we're accepting checks, we're going to get bad checks. We're going to get checks where people don't have enough money in the bank or floating their payment. And then you have the fraud, actually, that takes place as well. But so as long as we're still accepting checks, we're still going to get some bad checks, even with credit and debit cards. We could change that, but I'm just saying that in the initial rollout, we're trying to expand options, not limit.
A lot of people don't take checks anymore, I just got to tell you.
Yeah, I know. Hardly anybody, other than your mortgage payment.
And it's in your plan, right?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I need to move us along. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Do you have anything else you want to add?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Senate Bill 818. No one else? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 818, and we'll move back up to Senate Bill 872. We're open on that now. And let's see here. I think it's Aaron Woodman, Peter Lunn, and Lindsay, not sure the last name, from Pipeworks. Eugene. Whoever wants to go first.
Great. Chair Baer and members of the committee, my name is Erin Goodman, and I'm a casting director and a native Oregonian based in Portland. I've worked for Cast Iron Studios, a local film and television casting company, for the past 9.5 years. The Oregon Production Incentive Fund has had a dramatic effect on everyone employed by Cast Iron Studios, and I'm here today to share my story. I began as a casting assistant in 2006. In 2009, thanks to OPIF, the TNT series Leverage decided to shoot in Oregon. This was during the depth of the recession, so instead of being laid off, I was promoted to casting associate and got to work on the first TV series to shoot in Oregon since the 1990s. Leverage not only helped us keep the doors open during a difficult time, but the training I received by working several seasons on this show enabled me to be promoted to full casting director in 2011. Since then, I have worked as a casting director on Grimm and many other projects and have watched the company grow and flourish, all thanks to OPIF. Last year, we had set the goal to get revenue back to pre-recession levels, but when legislature's expansion of the program made it possible for us to cast Wild and The Librarians, in addition to Grimm, we blew past all of our projections and had to have our busiest year on record. In just 1 year, my boss bought all new computers for the office, established the company's first employer-matched retirement plan, paid generous bonuses to full-time staff, created 2 new part-time positions, and gave raises to all existing employees. Needless to say, we've already decided that if SB 872 passes this session, we'll be bringing on another full-time employee to handle the workload. On a personal note, the increase in my income last year meant that I was able to buy my first home in District 46 and start an employer-matched IRA. While home ownership and a retirement fund had long been goals of mine, the arrival of my daughter, she's back there, in December was the real game changer. Thanks to the incredible growth in our company, due in no small part to OPIF, I was lucky enough to be granted 3 months of paid maternity leave. We constantly hear about the workplace needing to support families, and I'm so proud to be a part of a company that has been able to do just that. These past 3 months have been nothing short of incredible, and I'm so grateful to be returning to such an supportive environment. Today is actually my first day officially back on the clock. One final subject I would like to touch upon is how Oregon Film and Television production benefits local charities and nonprofits. Our company has for many years hosted a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank around Christmas time, allowing any actor who brings us just a few cans of food to audition for us. Last year, we raised over 2,500 meals for the food bank in just 5 hours. Even more impressively, Grimm cast members recently established the Grimster Endowment Fund for patients and families at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. The gala they hosted in February raised a staggering $310,000 and will permanently endow the fund, so it lives on in perpetuity at the Dornbecker Foundation. All of the OPIF-supported TV series have donated countless items to fundraising auctions since setting up shop in Oregon, including props, costumes, autograph posters, and set visits, with proceeds supporting the arts, education, and more. Therefore, the incentive program has not only helped our industry create real family-wage jobs with benefits like mine, but it has helped to make a big difference in the lives of the sick, the needy, and the hungry across the state. So I'm here today with my daughter, Margaret. Who has great timing.
Mom, you're taking too long.
To urge you to support the expansion of this highly successful program. We're truly counting on it to support our families. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and that does make me the person to talk to in case you ever want to show up on Grimm.
I got some people I would recommend for that program.
I have an email address.
Some of them might be in this room, huh?
Some of them need very little makeup, huh? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for your time this afternoon. My name is Peter Lund, and I'm here on behalf of an exciting and growing industry. Some of us know it as interactive media. Some call it interactive games, some entertainment software, but most of us think of them as video games. In my day job, I'm the chief operating officer of a company called Super Genius in Oregon City. And in my free time, I serve on the Clackamas County Economic Development Commission and the board of the Clackamas Workforce Investment Council. I'm proud that Oregon is a place where people enjoy a wonderful quality of life and come to build businesses and jobs that help us thrive, and I do what I can to keep it that way, which is why I'm here today. Super Genius is a game developer that helps other game developers. We work with clients like Activision, Double Fine, Telltale, and Disney to produce some of the best games in the world. We employ animators, 2D and 3D artists, visual effects experts, developers, and programmers, all some of the finest in their chosen field. In an industry that increasingly relies on outsourcing and remote teams, we've grown a studio whose strength is an in-house, full-time staff. Last year, we grew from 20 to 30 employees, and this year we plan to hire at least 12 more. We're hungry for growth, but we have a responsibility to our community and to our employees to grow intelligently. We identified three things that would make us stronger: a thriving industry cluster, better access to a qualified workforce, and access to capital. We do our best to find these things ourselves. For example, we work with Clackamas Community College to co-develop the game development curriculum with the college's media department. We hope to provide affordable alternatives to the for-profit colleges that are often the only options for people interested in our field. But as one company, we're limited in what we can do. Humans work better in teams, and that's why we've been so honored to be one of the organizers of the Oregon Games Organization, which is our state's first video game based organization, along with the Technology Association of Oregon. One of the most interesting things I discovered during this process is where we actually make games in this state. Many assume that game development is mainly a Portland thing, but this isn't the case. The largest industry cluster in the state is, in fact, in Eugene, where you'll find a large number of large and medium-sized companies like Zynga, Rocku, and Pipeworks, all the way down to garage indie shops. You'll find Sony's Bend Studio, of course, in Bend. They employ a large team of developers and artists full-time. You'll find Mountain Machine Games and Clutch Play Games in Portland, Soma Games in Newburgh, and our shop in Oregon City, to name a few. Interactive Games dot the Oregon map. The OGO board is full of interesting people from around the state, all committed to growing the games industry in Oregon. And when we formed, we asked ourselves what we needed to focus on as an industry, and lo and behold, they were the same issues we face as a studio: environment, talent, and capital. OGO advocates for policies and programs at the local and state levels that will encourage a thriving games ecosystem. We promote partnerships with our educational institutions to foster a secure workforce pipeline, and we're looking at new ways to fill the industry-wide funding gap. We strongly support the bill before the committee today. The Oregon Production Investment Fund has done a lot of good for the media industry in this state. The Oregon Film Office has done an excellent job of cementing our state as a media production destination. Video game developers have benefited from our recent access to IOPIF. Super Genius has taken advantage of the program. Tacoma, the second game from the Fulbright Company, is being supported by OPIF. And perhaps my favorite story comes from a shop in downtown Newburgh. Recently, they acquired the license to produce games based on Brian Jake's best-selling Redwall series. The book series stars brave sword-wielding mice and sold over 20 million copies worldwide. Considering the subject matter, it's somehow fitting that a small and ambitious company is building such a large and exciting project. Redwall, the Warrior Reborn, is the first major project in what's likely to be a long series of Redwall-related games, all of which will rely heavily on Oregon labor, vendors, and local talent. With a total budget of $1.2 million that includes production, support, and ongoing marketing, SOMA expects the project to generate at least a dozen full-time and high-paying Oregon jobs up front, and up to 30 independent contractor vendors and vendor positions in the first year alone. SOMA just applied for the IOPIF incentive program, and the support it would give to this company and to downtown Newburgh would be substantial. These incentive programs work. But how well do they work for interactive games? Our state's data set is still small when it comes to video games, so I looked at programs around the country and found some numbers very interesting, specifically some multi-year program performance numbers I received from the Entertainment Software Association regarding the Texas program. The way we calculate our incentive in Oregon is a bit different from how my numbers were calculated, so I like looking at the return ratios rather than the dollar figures themselves. For each economic incentive dollar spent, TV generates $5.42 in economic activity. Feature films generated $6.46, and each incentive dollar spent in video games generated $9.67. Now let's look at the types of jobs these programs support. In film, 9.3% of the jobs were full-time equivalent jobs. TV came in at 14.6%. In video games, 88% of the incentive-supported jobs were full-time. The video game industry in Oregon isn't as large as TV or film, but I think it's clear that we can pack a punch. Senate Bill 872 would do great things for our growing industry. Increasing the IOPIF allocation would be a boon to Main Street, Oregon, and increasing the fund at large and opening it up to video games and post-production, which is the -1 amendment, will help the Oregon media industry continue to thrive. On behalf of the Oregon Games Organization and Super Genius, I would like to thank you and the Oregon Legislature at large for your time today and for the tangible catalyst the legislature provides to our industry. With your help, we can grow and continue to reinvest in this excellent state. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is Lindsay Gupton. I'm the president of Pipeworks Software in Eugene, Oregon. Pipeworks is one of the longest standing game developers in the country. We've been around for 15 years since the early days of the industry in the heart of Eugene. Game developers are the people that make the video games that people play, much like Super Genius. We're also a small business. We make family-friendly games, and the IOPIF program has already had a profound impact on our studio, as well as the Oregon economy and the Eugene economy in particular. In some ways, we're a success story 15 years in the making, due in no small part due to IOPIF. It's been instrumental in significant job growth in our company and a profound shift in our business model, which I'll get to in a second. A little bit of history about the video game industry and Oregon and why it matters, as I imagine that would be a worthwhile question. Back in the early days of the video game industry in the 80s and 90s, Oregon, and Eugene in particular, was actually one of the world centers. And that's because of a company called Dynamics that was spun out of Eugene, the University of Oregon. And in its heyday, had about 300 people. This is in the 80s, all based in Eugene. Now, the problem is that the Oregon game industry was largely left behind during the boom years of the industry, kind of the early 2000s up through the recession. The industry is now estimated to be $111 billion worldwide. Kind of what happened in that time frame is that Oregon companies were gobbled up by out-of-state companies. The business in Seattle, in the Bay Area, in L.A., in Texas, other places that have incentives grew rapidly. Dynamics closed in 2001. Due to the recession, Portland largely disappeared from the game development map until recently, and then Eugene lost several studios. Now, fast forward to today, due to the rise of a number of things, one of them is the ubiquitous game device that we all carry around in our pockets called a phone. Another is the rise of independent development, and fueled by IOPIF, there is a real resurgence happening in Oregon now in the game industry. As a case study, I'll give you some facts about Pipeworks. So, first of all, IOPIF was instrumental in us securing game projects. One of the first, Godzilla Smash 3, this was actually the first game that was released that was supported by the IOPIF funds last year. It's a big success story, one of the biggest game success stories of last year. Had over 5 million downloads and an almost perfect user on the App Store. Continues to be sold today. love the game. It's a lot of fun. Another one was World Series of Poker that we did with the World Series of Poker company. On the one hand, it's a beautiful 3D poker game, but the significant thing is that a technological breakthrough that we created that was helped fund by the IOPIF fund that allows players on consoles, PCs, and tablet devices to all play together at the same time, you know, on the same table in the same game. And that's a much harder technological breakthrough than it sounds to be. Third one is Strike Group Defender for something completely different. This is with the United States Navy and MIT. And this is a simulation that we created that's used to train sailors in the line of fire to better defend themselves from shipborne missile attacks. It's a very hard thing to train for in real life, but a computer simulation is an excellent use for training. Since it's been released, it's now in deployment across the entire Navy. It's being taught at the Naval Postgraduate Institute, and it won Serious Game of the Year last year, which is the highest industry award for games that strive to have a profound impact. And then last but not least, on the left, Soccer Die. This is our first totally original game, and it's releasing today. If you check after this hearing, it'll probably be up on the Apple App Store. This was a love letter to the games that we grew up playing in the 80s, kind of an homage to older games. And we're doing a worldwide streaming broadcast tomorrow on Twitch and YouTube for the first ever Soccer Die World Championships. So from these games and the success of these games, it's enabled us to grow and change our business model significantly. Pipeworks had 38 employees prior to the start of OPIF about 18 months ago. Since then, we've added 21 jobs. These 21 jobs have added $1.43 million in annual payroll and benefits, so significant impact to our company and the economy. And as Peter mentioned, these are full-time jobs with excellent benefits. And you can see, doing the math, that they're well-paying positions. There are entry-level positions through senior that we've added. And these have added directly engineers, artists, designers, animators, audio experts, producers, finance people, QA testers, admin, and IT. My forecast shows up to an additional 19 jobs by year's end. So a significant impact. But maybe one of the most profound impacts of this is that in addition to changes our business model that this has done, it allowed us to spin off our company. Until 6 months ago, we were actually owned by a large California-based conglomerate, a number of different developers. But 6 months ago, we actually spun off the company, and we're now back to being an independent Oregon-owned corporation. We have shifted our business model from largely doing work-for-hire contract-based projects to internally funded original games in creation, all handcrafted in Oregon. We now have 4 original games in development, which is a massive shift from before. And we continue to work with some of the best media companies around. In fact, we're now working with Skybound, the creators of Walking Dead, in partnership with our friends at Super Genius here on a new project. This would have been extremely hard to do without the support of IOPIF due to the many business challenges that exist in this. And right now, the only problem with the fund is that it's been a victim of its own success. As Tim said, the funds are oversubscribed on the first day, and it's a significant limiter towards the additional growth in the state at large. And I'd love to see Oregon become one of the top game centers in the world as we were years ago. Thanks again. Happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? No one else? Well, then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 872. We do not have all of the paperwork, so we cannot take action on that today. And I think that brings us to the end of our agenda. Unless there's anything else, we are done for the day, so we will adjourn. We'll adjourn.